Welcome to Law Talks. I'm Jonathan Birchall. Law Talks is a series of podcasts on international human rights law. It's produced by the Open Society Justice Initiative, part of the Open Society Foundations. Our guest for today's edition is Marion Isabel, a human rights lawyer based in our Budapest office who focuses on issues of pre-trial justice. That's what happens to people who are suspected of a crime between the time that they're first detained by police for questioning and, if they're charged, the time they arrive in court for trial. And in particular, Marion works on efforts to ensure a suspect's arrest rights, to make sure that the procedure, the way that they're treated when this happens to them, is in accordance with international human rights standards. So, Marion, to begin with, when we talk about arrest rights, what are we talking about?
Well, I think you summarised it quite well. When we're talking about arrest rights, we're broadly talking about those fair trial rights that are applicable to the pre-trial stages of the criminal justice process. So what we really do is we focus on the police station and we focus on what rights a person has when they've first been arrested. We kind of splice off that earliest part of a person's first contact with the criminal justice process. We've seen that the first few hours and the first few days can be a really crucial period of time in the criminal justice process in that lead up to trial. And so we look at specifically what rights a person has at that stage.
And are those rights, do they vary a lot between different countries? What are the issues there?
They vary dramatically between different countries. And I think this is really one of the most important messages that I have to give when I talk about arrest rights. It's this idea that people assume from watching American police shows that they know what will happen to them if they're arrested, and they'll have the certain rights that they'll be able to, you know, exercise when they're at the police station. And people are often shocked to find out, given that we travel so much between country and country, that depending on where you are has a dramatic impact on what rights you can actually exercise when you've been arrested. I often kind of ask people to imagine what they think will happen if they're arrested in a particular country, if they're traveling overseas to Spain or France or Hungary or Africa. And I try to get them to imagine what they would do if they were arrested. You know, they're sitting in a police station. Maybe nobody knows that they're there. They're alone. Everybody around them is speaking a language that they don't understand. I try to get them to imagine what they would do. And people often say that they would, say, call a friend or call their embassy. But you don't necessarily actually have those rights in a lot of these countries.
Is there a worst-case country to be arrested that you could give an example of?
I always feel terrible for the people of Nigeria, but yes, Nigeria is probably one of the worst. Statistically, the average time that people spend in pretrial detention in Nigeria is 3.7 years. That's 3.7 years of sitting in detention in either a police detention cell or a prison. And you are meant to be presumed innocent until proven guilty. You haven't actually been to trial. You haven't had a chance to state your case in front of a judge. And that's 4 years of your life.
So what are the international standards that we'd like to see applied in the procedures?
So the international standards are varied, and they draw from quite a number of different sources. So it's probably worth talking a little bit about what the sources are. There's no specific convention that deals with all of your arrest rights or all of your pretrial detention rights all at once. Instead, you can look at international universal instruments, such as the Universal Declaration of Human Rights and the International Covenant on Civil and Political Rights. And then there's also really important regional instruments, so such as the European Convention on Human Rights, the African Charter on Human and People's Rights, and the American Convention on Human Rights. And then on top of those two levels, you also have all of the different bodies, tribunals, and courts that have expanded and clarified these original sources.
So presumably the international big documents don't say, yes, you can call a lawyer within 24 hours, or no, you can't be held silently for three months. There's nothing like that specific in those overall big documents.
The overall big documents do have some specific criminal defence rights. It's just a matter of
Interpreting them,
I guess, and looking quite clearly at how the courts have interpreted them over the years.
So what are the basic rights that you get from those international conventions?
There's really quite a broad range of the rights that you have at pretrial detention stage. The first one, and really the most broad, is the right to liberty. So when we look at the right to liberty, we're not saying that there you have a right not to ever be arrested, but that if you are deprived of your liberty, it can only be on such grounds and in accordance with such procedure as established by law. So it can't be completely arbitrary. The second idea inside the right to liberty is that it's a general rule that people who are awaiting trial shall not be detained in custody. So certainly the state authorities have a right to keep some people in detention awaiting trial, but the general rule, the presumption that's on your side, is that you should be allowed to walk free and show up to court to have your trial on the day.
So presumably the state should have to prove that you're somehow a risk to society to be allowed free or a flight risk.
Exactly.
Otherwise they should let you out.
Exactly. And when we look at the jurisprudence of the American, the African and the European courts, we can distill a set of principles of when pretrial detention is okay to be imposed upon a person. The most important rule is that pretrial detention is precautionary, not punitive. Mm. So it's not enough that the police simply suspect that you've committed a crime or that crime that they suspect you of is a very grave crime. Past a certain point, they can't just keep you in pretrial detention indefinitely purely on that basis. Instead, you've got to look beyond the gravity of the crime. You've got to look at the risk of the person absconding, the risk of the person reoffending when they're out, the risk of them destroying evidence or perhaps harming or contacting witnesses. All of these kind of principles play into when pretrial detention is acceptable and when it is not acceptable.
So we're effectively talking about bail here, right? So how do we ensure, or how do you try and ensure that a suspect gets a fair bail hearing and that the judge, who is presumably part of the judicial establishment, doesn't just assume that whatever the police is saying is perhaps what he should be doing?
Mm. We try to ensure that through, I guess, a combination of a few different standards and rights. So the first, and to my mind one of the most important, is that it's crucial that people, when they are first arrested, get the right to access legal representation. So they're not just brought into the police station and interrogated without a lawyer. They instead get to actually speak to a lawyer, get some legal advice, and understand what their rights are. And I say that that's one of the most fundamental rights because really we find in practice that the right to access legal representation underpins a lot of the other fundamental rights that you have in pretrial detention. Because if you have a lawyer, you're more likely to know what your other rights are. They're more likely to be respected because there's somebody on your side, somebody who can assist you and can advise you.
And presumably issues such as torture, it's less likely that you'll be beaten up by the police in an effort to get a confession if you've seen your lawyer and he could tell that you've been beaten up.
Exactly. I see the right to a lawyer as having a few different components. The first is the ability to actually advise you on what your rights are. But secondly, it's also that you have a bit of an impartial arbiter in that room with you. Often in those earliest periods of time, there's this incredible power imbalance in that interrogation room. There's that natural power imbalance that exists between the state authorities and a member of the public, but also a power imbalance of information, access to the case file, access to evidence, and having a lawyer in the room can go some way to redressing that power imbalance.
So, I mean, is it possible to give examples from specific countries on the right to access to a lawyer?
It certainly does vary dramatically between countries. It can be difficult to give specific examples because this is an area of law that we see quite a lot of flux in the last few years. Quite a few countries have recently done quite serious overhauls of their criminal justice system to allow for early access to legal representation. I'd say that a lot of this flux started in 2008 with the European Court of Human Rights judgment of Saldus and Turkey. And this was really a groundbreaking case that has caused quite significant impacts throughout Europe.
Can you run us through it and tell us who is Saldus and a bit of the background to the case and then about its impact?
Sure. So the case was a grand chamber decision of the European Court of Human Rights from 2008. And in this case, Saldus was a 17-year-old boy who was arrested by the Turkish police for being suspected of having participated in an illegal demonstration. He was interrogated by the police without a lawyer, without ever having seen a lawyer. And in that interrogation, he confessed to his participation in the demonstration. Now, later on, of course, he said in front of the judge that that confession was flawed, that the police had threatened to beat him, and that, in fact, he was innocent. He never participated in the demonstration. He was convicted on the basis of that first confession that he made in front of the police. Now, this got to the European Court of Human Rights, and the Grand Chamber held that in order for the right to a fair trial to remain sufficiently practical and effective, Article 6.1 of the Convention requires that, as a rule, people must have access to a lawyer as from the very first interrogation. The court did say that there are some exceptions to this. So if there are compelling reasons that a person should be denied their right to a lawyer, then that can happen. But the real kicker of this case is in the consequences. The court held that even if there are exceptional circumstances and you deny a person their right to a lawyer, you cannot use any statements made in the absence of a lawyer for a conviction. The reason why this was really groundbreaking is previously the European Court of Human Rights had taken a very broad, permissive view of the right to access a lawyer. So they had held for decades that people had the right to a lawyer from this early period.
But if somebody spontaneously confessed to police, then that was still good, even if the lawyer wasn't in the room?
Yes, they would look at kind of the fairness of the trial as a whole. And if you subsequently got a lawyer, or if you subsequently got to go to trial and argue that your confession wasn't real, then they looked at the fair trial as a whole and found that there was no breach. And so this case really changed a lot of things throughout Europe, and it's had quite surprising consequences.
What kind of consequences? Are other national governments changing the way they do things because of it?
It has, both directly and indirectly. In the last few years, we've seen quite a few governments across Europe change their criminal justice systems to allow for early access to legal representation. Now, this isn't purely or just because of the Saldars decision, but Saldars certainly played an enormous role in how these rights are viewed in European jurisdictions. So Scotland in 2010 and 2011 underwent quite massive reform of their criminal justice system, so that for the very first time, people in Scottish police stations had the right to access a lawyer from the very first moment of the deprivation of their liberty. France went through a very similar process in the last year or two. And we're also seeing some developments in countries like Belgium and the Netherlands that go some way towards implementing Saldars in their national jurisdiction.
So we have this ruling from the European Court of Human Rights, which covers all the members of the Council of Europe. But then within the European Union as well, I believe there's a debate going on over a draft directive on arrest rights, which would produce a standardized set of procedures across the members of the European Union. But what's the debate there at the moment?
The debate is really quite exciting. There are some really interesting developments across the EU. Let me just give you a little bit of background. In 2009, so after the Saldars decision, the European Council adopted what we call the roadmap. It's the roadmap for strengthening procedural rights of suspected or accused persons in criminal proceedings. Very catchy name. And this provided a framework, so really the framework for the creation of minimum standards across all EU countries. And the reason why this is so exciting is that we have a real problem with European Court of Human Rights judgments not being implemented in their domestic jurisdictions. So, for example, in the Saldars and Turkey judgment, although other countries have changed their laws after Saldars, Turkey, to my knowledge, hasn't taken any major steps towards reform. But the roadmap for strengthening procedural rights is really critical because it will actually create a binding, enforceable set of directives that lay out the minimum standards of what countries in the EU must do for people in pretrial detention.
So if you are a member of the EU, you have to do this?
Yes, it actually has teeth. Mm-hmm. There's a series of six measures, A through F, as part of the roadmap, and we're kind of partway through at the moment the drafting of each of them. So Measure A, which is the measure that deals with translation and interpretation, has already been agreed and adopted by member states. And so that by October 2012, no matter where you are in the EU, there will be a binding directive protecting your rights to interpretation and translation while you're in the police station.
So if you're a Slovakian arrested in Lithuania, you should get an account of your rights in Slovakian?
Yes.
Okay.
Yes.
And what are the other elements?
Well, Measure B, the next one, is about information on your rights and the charges against you. So it's really commonly known as the Letter of Rights Directive. This was recently agreed to by all of the member states of the EU, and we're just going through the final process of accepting it and making it law. And once that's passed, member states will have, I think, 2 years to change their domestic laws to be in accordance with that directive. The next one, Measure C, is about legal advice and legal aid. And this is where we're seeing really a lot of debate from member states. This is probably one of the more controversial measures, and it's difficult for states to agree on all of the different elements of when a person gets access to legal representation and when that should be paid for by the state.
Do you think there will be an overall directive on arrest rights, or do you think it's going to fall apart?
Oh, I certainly am optimistic that member states will be able to come to a fair and just conclusion that upholds the international standards. It is, of course, difficult in today's kind of current economy. Certainly the right to legal aid is one that we've seen a lot of pushback on from member states because, quite frankly, it's expensive. It can be difficult to implement. But the international standards exist for a reason, and they're there to protect people's rights, and it's crucial that it does go through in the coming years.
What's the relationship between the Saldus ruling and the European Court of Human Rights ruling and the rest of this of the directive reforms?
I think I see them as being all part of the same wave. It's just different ways of attacking the same problem. We have quite good international standards now from the European Court of Human Rights, but we have problems of implementation. And so one of the projects that the Justice Initiative is working on is trying to implement these international standards through various means, one of which is domestic litigation. So if you can go to your domestic courts in Poland or in France or in Spain or in Italy and say, this is what the international standards are, and our country needs to change its laws, then this can be quite an effective way of strategically litigating this point and creating quite significant change in your country.
Beyond Europe, can litigation also be used as a tool to strengthen arrest rights, or are there other approaches that are more effective?
Moving outside of Europe, there's also quite good regional standards of pretrial justice issues in both the African and the inter-American systems. So the African system, in the Principles and Guidelines on the Right to a Fair Trial and Legal Assistance in Africa, we actually have a very clear principle that states that people do have the right to legal assistance and that it applies at all stages of the criminal prosecution and that it begins when the accused is first detained or charged. So it's quite specific. Similarly, in the Inter-American Commission, there are principles that talk about the right that a person has to a lawyer without any delays or unjustified time limits.
But presumably the challenge is that those things might exist as principles, but they're not applied on the ground. So what kind of strategies do people use to try and change the reality of how law is applied at the local police station?
Well, I can talk a little bit about a pilot that the Justice Initiative is running in Sierra Leone to deal with this issue of early access to lawyers. One of the problems that Sierra Leone faces is that even though they have an enormous population, there's really only a few hundred lawyers in the country, and most of them are in the cities as opposed to rural areas. And so there's this real lack of, you know, actual people who could help even if they were given the right to.
So even if the police let you talk to a lawyer, there wouldn't be a lawyer to talk to?
There's nobody there. There's nobody in your community to help. So the Justice Initiative, working with a partner organisation called TMAP, has started a criminal justice pilot in a few of the rural areas of Sierra Leone. And this works through training and funding paralegals, so members of the community, to be in police stations and prisons and provide that frontline early access to legal assistance. And we've found that this can be incredibly effective in a situation where otherwise people wouldn't have anybody to assist them in police stations. They now have somebody who is trained in criminal law, who speaks their language, who can mediate between the police officers and the community and the victim of crime and the person who's been accused. And we're seeing quite enormous impacts in this area where the pilot is running.
So in countries like that, the effort is focused on training and capacity building at the grassroots level to try and implement the standards which exist at an international or national level.
Exactly.
So the Salvador's decision established the principle that you need to have a lawyer there. But presumably there are other refinements on when the lawyer arrives, questions like that. Has that been clarified by further litigation?
It has. In the Salvador's decision, the court simply said that you have the right to a lawyer as from the first interrogation. But subsequent case law has gone a little bit further and clarified when the lawyer actually gets to come into the room and speak to you. In the 2009 case of Dayanan and Turkey, the European Court of Human Rights pushed the case law a little bit further. And they said specifically that you should have a lawyer from the point that you're actually placed in custody or deprived of your liberty. So you can see that it's a little bit further from just as from the first interrogation that we saw in the Saldar's case. Interestingly, this case also said that even if you stay silent during your interrogations, and even if you make no incriminating statements whatsoever, your right to have a lawyer will still be breached if you didn't get the chance to see one. And this, you can see really how this changes things. So even if there is no actual harm in the particular case, there is still a breach. So it's quite a move away from this previous position that the European Court had, where they looked at the justice of the proceedings as a whole. It's a move away from that and instead kind of cementing an immutable principle about your right to access counsel. The next case that it's worthwhile to know about is a case called Brusco in France from 2010. And the reason why this case is important is because it was actually the first time that the European Court said that you have to have a lawyer inside the interrogation itself. In my mind, this was implied in the Saldar's decision.
Yeah, it sounds self-evident.
Exactly. But this really was the first time that the court, almost in a throwaway line, said almost as an afterthought, and of course you have to have a lawyer within the interrogation itself. And this is a big issue in many states. In some countries, you can talk to a lawyer before the interrogation, but when you walk into that room, you walk into that room alone.
Right. And are there other cases?
There's one more case. And this is the case of Shabelnik and Ukraine from 2009. In this case, Mr. Shabelnik was questioned as a witness, not as a suspect. But in his questioning, he confessed to the murder of a woman. The court held that at that point, at that moment that he first made his confession, obviously he was no longer just a witness, but he was an actual suspect. And thus he should have been afforded all of the legal safeguards that a suspect is afforded under Article 6 of the Convention. This is one of my favourite cases because this is such a big issue in a lot of countries. It's really common for police to try to wriggle out of their obligations by calling a person something else, by calling them a witness or an interested party, or by encouraging them to come and speak to them voluntarily. But this was the first time the court has said, no, we look at what that person is in actual fact. And if you are suspected of a crime, you have certain rights.
So you get access to a lawyer and you... Are there other principles which determine how your relationship with the lawyer is handled, or what privileges that relationship has?
Yes, there is. The European Court in particular has gone quite a fair way to explaining what access actually means in practice. We kind of look at a range of things. So the first thing to be aware of is that in order for you to have the right to a lawyer, you have to be informed of your right to a lawyer. And this sounds obvious, but it's often one of the biggest stumbling blocks to implementation that we see. You might have the right, but the police don't tell you, or they discourage you. Like, sure, you can see a lawyer, but it'll take so much longer if you do that. Let's just chat and you can go home. So it shows how problems arise when there's a positive obligation on the authorities. It's not enough to just make the information available in the sense that you could have asked for a lawyer if only you'd known. Instead, the court has held that it's a duty. It must be complied with positively. The next thing it's worth to be aware of is that you have a right to private and confidential communications with your lawyer. Again, this sounds like it's quite an obvious one, but it's really regularly breached in a lot of countries. I've heard police say that, of course, they listen into consultations between an arrested person and their lawyer because it's the best way to find out information. So it's really worth knowing that you have the right to meet your lawyer in private and to communicate with them in a fully confidential manner.
So pre-trial detention litigation often focuses on these very specific procedural issues, and then we have outside Europe the grassroots effort to engage lawyers and paralegals in trying to improve the way that people are treated. This presumably has implications that go beyond the simple violation of rights and has other real impacts on the suspects and their families.
It does indeed. I think I talk so much about the right to early access to a lawyer that sometimes it can appear to be quite a narrow right. But the Justice Initiative has done quite significant research on how it's linked to a whole host of other issues. For example, public health. If you have an inefficient system and you have people who are being detained in pretrial detention for a long period of time in chronically bad conditions, this can have quite significant effects on public health. So the consequences can be terrible. You can have the spread of HIV and tuberculosis and other infectious diseases. And it doesn't just affect those poor people who are held in pretrial detention, but it affects the people who are working in those centres as well, and the wider communities as people are released and go back to their families.
And presumably more broadly, it sort of discredits the justice system if you don't want to go near the police because you know you're not going to get even to the point of getting a fair trial.
Absolutely.
So it's a big issue which affects a whole range of human rights.
It does. We've also seen quite significant links with corruption. So much of the corruption that occurs in the justice system occurs in these very first few days of pretrial detention. It's when there's the least checks and balances on the power of the police and the biggest kind of incentives, I guess, to try to get a person to talk and to confess. And torture is related for exactly the same reason. It flourishes in these first few days of pretrial detention. The other related issue that people might not immediately think of is the socioeconomic impacts of excessive pretrial detention. So if the person who is detained are the breadwinners or the labourers and their families, then the family doesn't just lose that person's income, but they're often doubly punished because they have to somehow come up with money to support that person while they're in detention, to pay the guards, to find them food, to pay for a lawyer. So the socioeconomic impacts can be quite enormous as well.
It's an issue that can have impacts that go far beyond the judicial system to affect the society as a whole.
Absolutely.
Marion Isabel is a lawyer for the Open Society Justice Initiative who focuses on arrest rights and pretrial justice. You're listening to Law Talks, the podcast about international human rights law. Law Talks is produced by the Open Society Justice Initiative. To learn more about our work in international human rights, visit justiceinitiative.org. That's justiceinitiative.org. I'm Jonathan Birchall. Thanks for listening.